So, good evening once again. Don't know if it's the, in France, it's the holiday time. Everyone is away, and I don't know if that's why people aren't coming, or retreat fatigue, because we just finished a retreat. I don't know. But the people who are here on this screen are important, and you are mainly the people who come every single Monday night, which is great. And I'm happy to see you. And only João and I were at the retreat, so it's nice to see the other three who we did not see during our weekend. As often the case when there's a Dharma talk, I talk for a little bit and then I open it up for questions and we have a discussion, and that's always really rich. And it's not the same thing as a circle, to have to share whatever's happening. A circle is a different kind of thing than when we talk on these after Dharma talks. So at the same time, maybe because we are a small enough group, we can have more of a discussion instead of just me talking all the time. I'm not saying do a circle, but or we can. I was thinking about maybe I'll just share a little bit about what I was thinking today and yesterday after I left the retreat. I traveled in the car from Coimbra to first the train station in Coimbra, because we dropped off Antonio at this train station, and then we drove to Porto, and José Eduardo and Rory dropped me off at the airport. And then I went into the airport and I checked in and did everything I had to do and waited for the plane and then got on the plane and flew home. And my husband picked me up and we drove home. And all of this in the space of, I guess we left. Well, we left Coimbra, I think, around 11:30, and I got home to my house at 8. So it's relative, 9.5 hours, or whatever that is. But when I sit back with it, it's as if there's no time, and there's no place. I was always there, wherever it was. And it's conceptually, we understand it. We know that we get on an airplane and we fly at a really high speed, and then we cross all of Portugal, all of Spain, most of France, and we land in Paris. And so we know in numbers what that represents. It's the time as well. The hour is 1 hour, the flight is 1 hour and 50 minutes. So we know that, but conceptually that's the understanding. But my direct experience of that is not the time and the distance. It's just I'm always here, wherever it is. And there's this, I think it's the last koan in the collection, the Mumin Kan, where a monk asks a master, Master Kempo. He says, all of the Bhagavats, so all of the great ones of the 10 directions, have one way to nirvana. And he says to the teacher, I wonder where that one way is. And the teacher, so Kempo, he has a stick like mine. He takes his stick and he raises it. And he draws a line and he says, here it is. Here is the one way to nirvana. The koan goes on with something else, but that's what came. I can't remember how it goes after that, but because this was the part that came to my mind. It's like it's always here. Here it is. It's always here. So all that, traveling and being always here, because whatever I'm experiencing is here. I can't experience anything else. I couldn't experience. I mean, Zhuang could tell me what happened after we left, I'm sure, in Quimbra, but that's what was happening here for him. And that was also here. All of you could share what you were doing at that t exact time yesterday. That would also be here. And so when we say this is the one way to nirvana, it's because there is no other way, there is no other place but here. And that's a concept here, of course, but not experientially. Experientially, we're completely here, even if, our minds are wandering. Like Bernie Glassman, who at the beginning of a talk once said, or no, Bernie, the way he used to give talks was he would, at the beginning, he would say, ask questions, we'll write them down, and then the talk I will give the talk in response to those questions. And so one of the questions was something like, I feel like I'm not really here or something. My mind is scattered, or I feel like I'm not really present. I want to be more present in my life or something. Yeah, I think it was that. It wasn't here, it was present. And so when Bernie came to that question, he said, he read the question and he said, okay, everyone who is not present, please raise your hand. And a couple of people did raise their hand, and everyone else laughed. Well, it's kind of too bad that everyone laughed, although it is funny, right? But that's those people were acknowledging that they feel distant from here. They don't feel present, fully present in their life and where they are and what they're doing, which we can all relate to in different ways. And so Bernie was kind of joking with this thing, but it's also really points to the reality. Okay, so it's really easy to just be present. You just raise your, when they at you, the question is asked, you raise your hand. You're present right then and there. You're present. Or you don't raise your hand and then you're present too, So whatever you do in response to that question, you're present right where you are. And so when he raises his stick and draws a line and says, here it is, it seems really obvious. Well, okay, here it is. That's the way to nirvana, just this right here. But it can easily become conceptual. And of course, there's a lot of effort that goes into going from one place to another. Necessary. We have to do it. If we maybe also if we didn't have maybe if we were more connected with here it is, this is the way to nirvana, we wouldn't spend so much time, well, obviously, yes, we wouldn't spend much time coming and going. We wouldn't make so much effort coming and going. I'm trying to find this quote that I wrote down last week. Something about from Hakuin, who said, your going and returning takes place nowhere but where you are. So that's basically what I was saying. Your singing and dancing is none other than the voice of Dharma. So whatever it is you're doing is the voice of Dharma. And wherever you are, that's even if you're coming and going, you're always here, right where you are.
Roshi, can you say the first sentence,
Yes.
please?
Your going and returning takes place nowhere but where you are. So we have this idea, so I have this idea that I went to Portugal and I returned to France, but I was always right here, wherever I was. Singing and dancing is none other than the voice of Dharma. That's an inc you know, that's inciting us to see that everything in our life, whatever we're doing, is the voice of Dharma. And that maybe if we see that our going and returning takes place nowhere but where you are, we won't have so much desire to go somewhere else and think that we have to return to something else. Because it's always, we're always right there. I say maybe. I say maybe because we need to have that realization in order to not do so much going and returning. There is nowhere to go, actually. That's what we also said in the during a Dharma talk during the weekend, was that I don't remember even what we were talking about, but it was that good news, bad news thing where you're already here. So your coming and going takes place nowhere but here. The way to nirvana is here it is, or here it is, or here it is, whatever. That's the good news. You don't have to go somewhere else. It's already here. You're already here. It's the bad news in the sense that, oh no, it's just this. This is not what I was looking for. This is not what I expected. And I say this from experience, from when somebody first pointed this out to me, and I thought, oh no, I'm not going to become someone else. I'm not going to become different. I'm not going to be better. I'm not going to be extraordinary. I'm just, it's just this. Oh no. No, and I was desperate for a few hours. Until I sat with that and realized the depth and the meaning of that, of what it really means. And then I could connect with the joy of it. There's nowhere else to go. There's no need to go anywhere else. This is it, right here. Your singing and dancing is the voice of Dharma. And this is the basic Zen message, right? We have the famous chopping wood, carrying water, from Layman Peng. And Layman Peng was a really important example for us because he was a lay person like us. And he had a family. And the family, he had been a merchant, probably had some wealth. And it's not clear, there's the story that all of the family's belongings were on a boat crossing a river, and the boat sank. So they lost everything. Some people say that he sank it on purpose so that they had nothing. Others say that it was an accident. It's not really clear, but the story is that they lost everything when the boat sank. And he had a wife and a son and a daughter. And already he had been interested in Zen and visited a temple or masters nearby. But when they lost everything, they became itinerant and went from, basically life as pilgrimage. So they would go to different temples and see different teachers and study with them. And they weaved baskets and sold them in marketplaces. They did weaving with, baskets and dishes and whatever, I don't know, things like that. Maybe mats. They did weaving in any case and sold them in markets. And that was how they survived. That was the family's income while they were traveling. And that they could do anywhere, right? They could do that wherever they were staying, and they could sell it in the local markets and whatever. And that family really made life practice and practice life, and all the whole family practiced. And there's many koans and stories with all of the, in fact, stories that have become koans, which with all of them, each one of them features in a different way. Not so much the son, but the daughter and the wife and him. So that's a really great example. I've always found it very inspiring that that this lay person was a contemporary and a friend of many great masters. This was in 9th century China again. And there are a lot of stories that exist with him featuring in it. One of our beloved koans with it is beautiful snowflakes. They don't fall in a different place. So the story is that he was at a visiting him. I forget which master it was. I can't remember. And it was time for him to leave. And so a group of monks escorted him to the gate, which in the telling of the story is a sign that he was considered someone of importance if a committee of monks escorted him to the gate. And when they got to the gate of the temple, they saw that it was snowing heavily, and he looked up and he said, "Beautiful snowflakes, they don't fall in a different place," which is exactly what we're talking about. Here it is. So the snowflakes fall right here. Each snowflake falls in exactly in its place, and no two snowflakes fall in the same place. And as we know, no two snowflakes look alike. We can look under their crystals, and we look at them under a microscope. We can see that each one is totally unique, like us. And none of us fall in the same place as the others, or land, or live, or breathe in the same place as anyone else. And yet, we're all in the right place. This is our place here, right here. This is the way to nirvana, right here. And Layman Peng was a great example of you don't have to give up your family. Leave your home, leave your ordinary life, shave your head, give away your clothing, wear a special robe, follow rituals in a monastery. You don't have to do that. That is a way, and that too is the one way to nirvana. But that's the one way to nirvana for that person who is doing it. It's not necessarily the one way to nirvana for everybody. And to think that that's the way, and what the rest of us are doing is the way, is not the way. We miss the point. We miss the essence of what is practice. So some of us were sitting in a retreat during the weekend. Others weren't, but that doesn't mean that one way was the way to nirvana and the other way wasn't. Isn't. So maybe I'll stop there, and you can jump in if you want to say anything or questions or comments. Joao.
Hello, good evening, everyone. It's nice to see you. Yeah, so much of what you said resonated and different. It felt like it was feeling like touching on so many experiences, my own experiences, my own stories. Yes. I came back yesterday, kind of late, because I stayed behind, taking care of final wrapping up, making sure everything was in order, help from a couple of people. I went to get to put the rest of the material also with Nuno. Then we had lunch. We went for lunch, and then I had a train. I got on a train and I came home. And it's not it usually it doesn't happen. This time I was especially this morning. I just went out for I was taking care of some stuff, you know, doing see accounting about. The shopping and speaking with Elizabeth, speaking with Tiago, just sort out some final details. And I went out in the morning. I had school in the afternoon. I went out in the morning because I had some two pieces for the clarinets of my son David. They had arrived during the weekend, actually, and they were in a shop because I was not home, so I told them to put it in a shop where then I can pick them up. And I came back home. I had lunch and then I left for school. And it was especially when I went out in the morning. I had this like I was saying, it's not very usual, but how can I? I was wondering about this. I was feeling the need to consider, to think about, to observe how could the experience, like on a deeper level, the experience of the retreat, how I could, how I could keep that in my daily life, my day to day. I was kind of. Why? Yeah, I was kind of surprised why I felt that I needed to not worry, but pay attention to that. And actually, I remember I was walking down the street and they're doing some construction on the pavement. They're replacing something. So there were a couple of like three, four men there working. And I passed them. I had to go on the street because the sidewalk, everything is turned over and open. Disassembled. And I passed them and like in the most natural way, I had to say good morning. It was just good morning. And it's like it was that was saying good morning is like it was part of that moment. had to. It was that moment. It was like, so thinking back to the retreat, it's like, I don't actually look at the watch because I don't need to. So I know it's 8:20 when we finish sitting for the second period in the morning, when we get up to do kinin, I know it's 8:20, more or less. And if I am a Tenzo, I go out because I need to start preparing or finishing breakfast. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because I was trying to find how, in what way, which is the same, how did that was an integral part of that moment, passing through those people and saying good morning. It was, I don't know, the word that comes, it's natural. It's like it belongs there or something. It's like absolutely, yeah, it's an integral part of the moment, that moment. So I just realized this afterwards, actually, especially now that Roshi was talking. This and so and n now that I realize it, it's like that wondering, that I was having, how can the same kind of nature of the retreat, how is that kept in daily life? And somehow going back to that moment when I said good morning to those men, it's like it kind of answers it or something.
Well, I'm not sure if I know, I understand exactly what you mean, but that the if you when you were walking through the people in the street, if you tried to bring your things from the kitchen and cook, well, it wouldn't work. You respond to the moment that is there. So, if it's to stand up after the meditation and go to the kitchen, or if it's to walk through and say hello, or if it's to load the car or go to school, what it, if you try to carry some fixed response or some fixed feeling or hang on to some experience, well, then you'll have problems, you know.
Yeah, yes. Because when I respond, when I feel that I respond, and usually this comes afterwards, you were talking about it's always, we are always here, I'm always here, whatever that is. When that happens, when I respond fully, that's it. It's like the moment is full in its plenitude, plenitude, yes, it's like, yes, the moment is fulfilled or something.
So then, how can we carry that? We if we think of I don't know, any of the crises we feel in our life personally, or any difficulties, or in, if we expand it to more worldly the worldly world of the troubles that we know we encounter, also the joys. Can we include that? You know, say that the singing and dancing of the war in Israel and the war in Ukraine is the voice of the Dharma. Can we meet that with the same equanimity? It doesn't mean we like it, but can we respond and say, okay, this is it too. This is this too. Or, you know, the climate crisis or animal rights, you know, as usual, when I think animal rights or whatever it is that we're concerned with, whatever it is, can we respond in that same with equanimity? Which is not such an easy thing to do, you know, if it's a concept. Or if we have, you know, so João described his day of doing his things. I also had a very busy day with different activities that I had to go here and go there and talk to this person and do this, da, da, da. And if I had been, you know, trying to, one of the things was I had lunch with with a poet friend who lives in Tel Aviv and her husband who is Israeli. And had I been having lunch with some other people, the conversation might have been different. But because of their situation, and they're just visiting in Paris, because of their situation and because of the situation in which they live and the situation they are in as tourists and whatever, I didn't discuss the war in Israel like I would have with someone else, maybe. Not that I chose to avoid it, but it just wasn't the discussion to which I chose to direct my attention. It wasn't avoiding it, it was just directing my attention somewhere else to what we had in common, what was our subject. I wrote my book that's coming out, is what I did with her. And, you know, so we had many other things to talk about. And would it have been appropriate to engage in a huge argument about the Palestinian-Israel issue when we just have an hour and a half lunch together with someone, you know, I had never met him before? Would it have been appropriate? Would that have been the appropriate situation? It might have been. I didn't feel like it was. And I just trusted that. And they also didn't bring the subject up. And I can't, it didn't even cross my mind, actually. So it wasn't like I was consciously saying, okay, let's see, can we talk about this so we won't think that? It didn't even cross my mind. So it, can we bring, it's like during the retreat when I receive people in Dokusan, or anytime I receive people in Dokusan, I don't, when they walk in the room, I don't respond to them like the person who was there before them, like I would to the person before them. And I'm not thinking that they have the same subject or koan, or they will say the same thing as the person who was in the room before, or the person who comes after. I just have to drop everything and meet the situation as it is with the same equanimity. So like when João says, he just said hello to the people that you know, I'm extrapolating from what you said. I don't know if that's exactly what you meant, but that's what comes to mind for me. That whatever, you know, because you were sitting for 3 days, we know we sit for 3 days, we have our mind is clearer. And we have a different, it's different than when our mind is cloudy and confused. Very different. And so when we respond from that place of a clear mind, then we respond in a way that's different than when we don't have a clear mind. And yet it's all the voice of the Dharma, as Hakuin says. Yeah. Debbie.
Thinking of all of some of the things that happened while you all were not here. One was Saturday morning was really dishy for me because one because it was Joa and Freddie, whom I liked both of them very much, and me. That was it. Everybody else was somewhere else. And we talked about what you do in practice, which Joa had kind of launched saying that very often we don't talk about it. You know, specifically, what do you do? And I'm reading Mark Epstein's Thoughts with No Thinker, or Thinker with No Thought, yeah, Thoughts with No Thinker, where he really makes categories of this is vipassana and this is mindfulness. And as I was reading, I thought, well, I didn't know all this before, although I'm sure that a lot of it I've practiced and stuff. And so we were discussing is it useful to use the terms? Do you need to know that this is this kind of meditation, this is that kind of meditation, and how quickly? That was a little bit one of the things behind the text that Joa selected, was how easily this can become an intellectual game of I'm doing this. The minute you say I'm doing this, you're not doing it quite as much as you were before you started saying you were doing it. And this particular type of meditation is better than that. You know, it turns into, you have to be careful that it doesn't turn into some sort of, don't know, I do it better than you do it. We talked about in the beginning, one of the text that he chose was underlining different ways you can get messed up in the practice. And I think one of the first ones was by having a major experience, and then you can't let go, and everything else is minor after that. And I remember very much when I spent a lot of time in Belgium with Frank, he was talking about the fact that he got hooked on Mu big time because he had a big time moment, and then everything was kind of downhill for a while. And Roshi telling him, you know, that's not the, don't do that. So we were talking about the different pitfalls of practice, and it was delightful, and it's beautifully quiet in my home, and it was nice out and everything. And I in the evening I had planned a belated birthday party in the evening in Paris, so I left here and I got into the bus and it started. I don't know if you all have this often after Seishin, that everything is flowing along, and then all of a sudden we're back into the world. And it was like that, only it was between the morning and the afternoon. I get on the bus, some guy with one of those stupid scooters. Why don't they ride their scooter instead of having their scooter ride the bus? He's got a scooter on my foot. I try to get my hand onto the pole. He's leaning against everything I hate. All these manifestations of bad citizenship. And you shouldn't be doing this. And after about 5 minutes, it's fortunate that I'm not armed. Really, I was a mad woman. And I was hungry. Because I realized once I got to Paris, I thought, why don't you eat? You're a little bit hot under the collar. I realized the physical being of the expression hot and bothered. I was hot and bothered. But physically, I was like steaming. I was so mad. And that was just the beginning of the ride. A whole bunch of other things happened too, of course. And people leaning and bumping, and by the time I got to the Gare du Nord, I was like, let me out of here. And I had a rendezvous with Dale, so he said, can you wait for me? I said, no, I have to eat, because if I don't eat, I think I will shoot somebody. I don't have a gun yet, but I can buy one around here. So it was so interesting, the contrast of it. What happened? But it was this really special, very precious moment of intimacy with Joe and Freddie, and sharing our different feelings about practice and everything. So peaceful and quiet, and then you walk out into the war of the species. These are my brothers and sisters. They don't deserve to be my brothers and sisters. What am I doing out here? It was so funny. It was such an enormous contrast, which it often is when I leave here. But it's just that's what happens to me sometimes. As a matter of fact, I remember reading very early on some book about Zen. They said, don't drive your car right after you sit, especially in the Paris area, they should have put, because you're not violent enough to put up with it. You know, you're out there kind of, ooh, and everybody else is not in that same, in the same situation. It was like that Saturday when I didn't have a car, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, that's very instructive, though, to when we have that kind of experience, because then it makes things much more clear. We see, oh yeah, right. And not necessarily wanting to hang on to the peaceful peace and love thing and not engage in the rest of it, but it's really interesting to see those contrasts. And then, what does that mean? Like you say, what does that say? What is it? What gives rise to that in me, the hot and bothered? That's an American expression, so I don't know if you, anyone else understands it, but it's like, you know, you're hot and you're nervous and anxious or angry or disgruntled or something.
I didn't know that expression. I like it. It's really colorful, hot and bothered. And I was listening carefully to Debbie, and there seems to be a tendency to, or either we, you know, like a peaceful moment or a couple of hours, and then this other moment where you feel differently, and you feel hot and bothered. There seems to be a very strong tendency to you know, we immediately separate everything, you know, or I had a different experience before. Now it's this. I want to be like that. I don't want to be like this. I want to be that. Like that kind of person and not this kind of person, or the other way around, whatever. So immediately there seems to be this very strong tendency to pull everything apart and scatter all of this. Actually, the question that was, as I was listening to Debbie, the question that was coming to mind was, okay, so where were you at that moment? Where am I when I feel when I feel how I don't like to feel, or when I or when I want to feel different.
Well, and it can also be, you know, if we really look into the heart of it, of the matter, someone told me recently that she's a mother and she has two grown, pretty much, well, one child is like 30 years old and the other one, I don't know how old. And that she feels like she has never really experienced love, and that she, even her children, that she feels like there's something fake about it. And it's not that she doesn't love them, that's not it, but it's like in her allowing herself to be touched, the depth of it, of just, you know, purely allowing oneself to be touched. And this was, you know, that's a terrible thing to experience, to acknowledge, you know, but that involves really looking into it. And I think, you know, in all of what we're saying, I think, but I look at my own experience, that part of it is that the fundamental, the ground of being is uncertain. You know, it's impermanent. It's not fixed. It's uncertain. So, you know, one of the marks of our being is uncertainty. And in order not to face that uncertainty, we, make all kinds of fixed things. I'm like this, or I'm like that, or I'm not like this, I'm not like that. I want this, I don't want that. Or even, I don't want to look at that. I think one of the big things with the climate issue, the climate crisis, is that basically, we as human beings, we don't want to look into the uncertainty of it. That we don't really, I mean, the scientists say, okay, we're going in a bad place. We don't really know, though, how it's going to be and when it's going to happen and how bad it's going to get. There's all kinds of projections and things and statistics, but basically, it's uncertain. And nobody, very few of us really want to look at that, look at the uncertainty of it. And so we choose not to look at it. And that's not even like climate denial. It's not even, it's not the denial aspect. It's just like they're not looking at it, or not behaving according to what, if we really looked at it, then we would behave differently, probably. So if we can become comfortable with the uncertainty, that changes then how we behave. Whether it's, in going from the peaceful, study group to the bus with the guy who's like doing everything you don't want him to be doing and what he's not supposed to be doing, or leaving the retreat or missing the plane, or I didn't miss the plane, but I could have, whatever it was. And all of it is just uncertain. We just don't know. And if we can become more comfortable with that uncertainty, then it's, we don't have the same, we don't behave in the same way then. Because it's really the uncertainty that makes us so hot and bothered to a certain extent, and makes us hang on to things and not want to let go of things and, oppress others and, be wasteful and inattentive, and because we don't really want to be attentive to what the reality is. I'm kind of, extrapolating my on my own experience of this, but I think it's, it touches really to the heart of the Buddha's teaching, about uncertainty.
Well, and just to a tad in my own defense, I'm not a total sociopath. This is all very physical. And these people are about twice my size. And I get to the gal to know I have been spun around and lifted up and thrown back and everything. So yeah, I was, and then normally Saturday at that time of the day, because not all my bus rides are like this. But for some reason, recently, there have been a lot of traffic in the afternoon. So I'm a lot of it is I'm trying not to get so mad that I get myself in more trouble, because some of these guys, they come from war zones and stuff. If I start sounding off, which I used to do, hey buddy, don't, I could go south. So I have to stay calm in the midst of all this nonsense when what I really want to do is fight. But it's not much, there's not much mental events going on. It's pretty much a breathe, breathe. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Maybe I'll ask a question.
Please
Yeah.
do.
I've talked with a person I don't even know in Facebook, and she asked me, I want to do a meditation where everything happens at once. And I had no idea how to instruct her, because I told her, find a sangha, and she told me, I can't be around other people. I just could give her that advice, find a sangha, read books, but It's uncertain, right? I have no idea how to help that person, but perhaps talk to her again and try to make her feel, establish some kind of contact with her. And I don't know, I guess that's progress because I have no idea how to help her.
So when she says, I want meditation, what did she say? I want meditation where everything is all at once. Is it that?
Yes.
Well, any meditation is that, actually. If you really do it, it's all at one. There's no other place where it is. So I'm not quite sure what she means. And the fact that she doesn't. She can't be with other people, meaning because she's not comfortable or something. I don't know, right? But the best thing you can do is just to speak from your own experience, you know? So, what is meditation for you? And what is it to be with other people in a sangha for you? And respond to where she. Who where to her where she is, which is I don't want to be with other people. But you can say, okay, I understand that. My experience is that, like you say, a sangha is something else. It's not just like being with other people. I don't know. The best thing is always to speak from your heart, from your own experience, and not launch into ideas about what meditation is and what it's not, and except from what you how you feel it is, you know.
Okay, thank you. And maybe I'll ask something about me. I've been meditating here with my back to the board, so I don't know. I have problems in my back. I sometimes wonder if I'm ruining my back sometimes for not having the right posture.
And that is important, huh? To find the posture that works for you. So when you're sitting, are you sitting cross-legged or are you sitting on a chair or what? I don't
I'm
know.
sitting cross-legged in a bed.
Okay, yeah, that's not the best posture, but that's we're on Zoom, so it's kind of like we do what we can, right? I'm sitting in a chair in front of a desk, so it's not great either, but it is something to be attentive to, though. Finding a posture that's appropriate. Someone at the retreat where we were told me that he had hurt his hip by sitting not properly, you know, and like constantly trying to adjust and find a right posture, and yet was doing not sitting appropriately and hurt his hip. And that can happen, you know. So it's good to really follow the basics of have your feet on the ground and your butt on a chair, or you're sitting on the ground, your knees as close to the ground as possible, and the back straight, not kind of like this, but not also like this. The shoulders straight as well. And the head almost as if there was a string, you know, pulling you up like a puppet or something. To really find that posture that works for you. And even then, like I used to sit for years and years and years, you know, half lotus on a cushion, no problem. But then at some point, it was not good for my hips or my back. And an osteopath said, you know, and my knees actually too. An osteopath said, you know, you really shouldn't do that. That's not, you know, it's not gonna help your knees and your back by doing that. So I started sitting on a chair, which is not I had to let go of, my great posture, sitting half lotus on the floor on a cushion, So yeah, it is something to pay attention to, absolutely.
If I may, well, now we don't have much time, and yeah, that's really important. And if I may, I can easily see with you, João. We can meet, and because I always did that. That's really important to start there. Really good posture, and a lot of stuff can really hurt us. That's the most important thing. A lot of things can really hurt us, and if we don't have some degree of comfort, actually, it will never. I remember it was Effie once. She talked about that. If you don't have a certain degree of comfort, like physical, bodily comfort, your mind won't do anything else except think about it. I'm glad to to meet you soon. We can certainly find a place and a time, and maybe I can help you with that. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And what you said, Roshi, yes, I also felt that I had to change at a certain point because I think as we grow old, changes, the body ch also changes, and we need to adapt. And if we have some certain basic points in mind, it's really helpful because later on we are able to adjust because we know our body better. And so it's easier, it becomes easier to realize that we need to adjust or to change something, sometimes very radically. Yeah. And so if we pay some attention to that, it really will help us all, throughout our life, our sitting as we sit.
We find the right amount, the equivalent of in Oriyoke, we find the right amount, which changes all the time, obviously. Okay, so I think we should stop there. Thank you.